The regular season is heating up, new stars are emerging, and that means more opportunities to win up to 25 times your cash on Prize Picks, the most exciting way to play daily fantasy sports. Just select two or more players, pick more or less on their projection on a wide variety of stats, and place your entry. It's that easy. Let it fly to turn $10 into $250 with just a few taps. Easy gameplay, quick withdrawals, and injury insurance on your picks are what make Prize Picks the number one daily fantasy sports app. Watch your favorite players and get paid doing it this basketball season. See your entries make progress during the game or make new entries for the second half and the fourth quarter. Three-pointers, assists, rebounds, and everything in between are yours for the taking. Join the Prize Picks community of more than 7 million players who have already signed up. Right now, Prize Picks will match your first deposit of up to $100. Just download the Prize Picks app and use code GET100. That's code GET100 on Prize Picks for a first deposit match of up to $100. Prize Picks, pick more, pick less. It's that easy.
Read that Dave D's no longer with us, but Mickey and Titch and I just like to carry on the good work that's always gone down in number two.
All through the day, I'm in mine. All through the night, I'm in mine.
So that was the last recording session during the Beatles' lifetime, minus John. Of course, it being a George song, that might have been business as usual.
Yeah.
But they're wrapping up the loose ends for the Let It Be album soundtrack that's coming out. And they didn't have a decent take of I, Me, Mine, a studio multi-track tape, because they'd only done it the one time in rehearsal at Twickenham. And because Michael Lindsay Hogg really wanted to use that footage of John and Yoko waltzing.
Yeah.
But the footage he didn't use was of John utterly dissing that song first upon hearing it, saying, you know, we don't do Spanish waltzes in this band. And, you know,
right.
But meanwhile, the other three get down to business and really start to turn it into something.
Yeah.
But they needed it for the soundtrack album. So.
And of course, it was extended by Spector, wasn't it?
It was like a minute and a half song, which is another curious thing.
Yeah.
But. There You Have, which was released on Anthology 3, George's little comic intro to the session about, you know, referencing the member who's not there.
Right. And he's referring to the British band Dave D, Dozy, Beaky, Mick and Titch.
Yes.
Who had a number of different hits. One of them, I remember, was The Legend of Xanadu.
Mm-hmm.
That, you know, quite a few hits. Dave D, who went on to become an A&R guy, he was the policeman who, you know, happened upon the accident of Eddie Cochran.
And copped his guitar.
Absolutely, that's how he learned to play guitar.
Yeah, that's a great little backstory there. But that was an act that did nothing in America. So when that surfaced on Anthology, I think they really had to annotate it for American audiences. Like, you know, who the hell is he talking about?
Right. Yeah.
But he is making the little comic announcement there because... You go back to the September meeting at Apple, which George was not present at, by the way, because his mother was ill.
But yeah, September 69.
And that's when, in response to Paul's prodding them to do something at that moment, you know, get the Beatles back into the clubs and, you know, unannounced and get their mojo back.
And actually, which I have to say, I totally agree with that approach.
It would have been amazing.
Well, what Paul clued in to was the fact that not performing live...
Mm-hmm.
had, you know, caused this sort of fracture in the band dynamic.
Yes.
You know, and that when they were gigging, that's what kept them close together.
Knowing what there is to know about the Twickenham sessions and then the Apple Studio sessions and George's walkout, all this incredibly detailed stuff from that Get Back, Let It Be project, and then you watch the footage of them on the roof, how they pull together, they're clearly having a great time. Is it the best performance ever? No, but there's some things that are amazing.
Absolutely.
I mean, I always thought it was kind of ironic that the song that they played the most during those sessions and rehearsed, Get Back, came off the worst.
Yeah.
But you know, I Got a Feeling, it's amazing. Dig a Pony, you can, you know, you can debate the merits of it as a composition, but the performance is great.
Yeah.
One After 909.
Yeah. It's just, you can see that they get into it. They enjoy it, especially John and Paul. I mean,
yes.
George is a bit more withdrawn. As we know, he withheld all of his material from the Rooftop concert.
He did. But he's still getting into it. And there's that little funny moment where when you're doing Dig a Pony, which, of course, is so non-linear in the lyrics that, you know, John needed a little help. And so he had that guy, Kevin, the redhead guy, holding the clipboard in front of him with the lyrics. And then George gets down next to him.
That's right. Yeah, as if they're all bowing down to John.
Right.
Yeah.
It's funny.
Yeah.
So... anyway, so Paul is pushing this notion, which later on he would take up with Wings,
yes.
these little hit-and-run gigs. You know, John wants no part of it. He's just played the Varsity Stadium show in Toronto.
Yeah.
And, you know, played before 20,000 people, got a buzz off it.
Made out with Yoko on stage in front of 20,000 people as well.
Yeah, and he was buzzing on heroin as well.
Yeah.
You know, so that was still going
with Clapton
on.
And Yoko.
Yeah, absolutely. So... he's not in any kind of mood to be pushed into doing this with the Beatles. Now that he's kind of, you know, the story was that he told people privately on the plane.
Well, he told Klein, didn't he?
He told Klein, he told Ray Connolly, the journalist.
Yeah.
And
Klein is basically saying, look, we're still negotiating a deal with EMI.
Yeah.
You know, let's just keep this undercover.
Right. But that was the famous, I want a divorce, where he goes, I wasn't going to tell you, Paul, but I want a divorce.
Well, he's basically knocking down everything that Paul suggests.
Yeah.
No. And
yes.
Paul's like, you know, what's this about?
Because you're in a situation, it's like, you know, arguing with your wife or something. You have to say something just because you want this to stop.
Yeah.
You want it to go away.
Yeah.
And
well,
now,
your wife may be, but yeah. We now know the Rodriguez approach to marriage.
Every time I say I quit in the band, you know, that stops the argument cold. But anyway, so the thing is, now you've got privately, John supposedly had quit the band. I do think that Paul, hearing these words that he'd been dreading to hear from John for so long.
Do you think he'd been dreading?
I think so.
Or even expecting.
I think that he'd been going out of his way ever since John and Yoko connected to tread lightly around John, to engage him as much as possible.
Yeah.
Here, John, you play the lead solo on my new next Beatles single song.
Ooh, that's a shiny new guitar. I like that.
Yeah, exactly. And literally, that's the case with For You Blue.
Yeah.
You know, he's been dissing George's material for quite some time now.
Yeah.
George brings in, you know, John had been complaining about, oh, this song's got too many chords. This is too complex. I can't learn this. So... George brings in a 12-bar blues song, which, you know, they could have played in their sleep.
Yeah.
John, how about you take the solo?
Yes.
Here's this shiny new lap steel guitar. You know, you can use your lighter.
Use your lighter.
Yeah. So, and I think those were the little tricks they would do to keep John engaged.
Yeah.
Is, you know, just throw him a bone, you know, keep him interested.
Well, there's also that story about even during the Abbey Road sessions when John and Yoko have had the car accident in Scotland.
Mm-hmm.
And apparently, like, on the day when they're coming back in, mm-hmm. there's nervousness, you know, on the part of George and Paul and Ringo as to what John they're going to encounter.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. That was, and it ended up being fine.
Yeah.
Although I always thought it was really funny that the song they choose to work on to greet him is Maxwell Silver Hammer.
Oh, yeah.
He's already on record as...
That would really endear him, wouldn't it?
Yeah. Not being one of his favorite tunes.
Something else I want to say as well, though, you know, what we had at the beginning of the show and the Beaky McIntitchell...
Mm-hmm.
comment by George, that's always been intriguing to me because we know how things played out thereafter,
mm-hmm.
where it's, you know, and it had already been playing out that way, which was the other three versus Paul.
Mm-hmm.
And yet here that day, you know, it's as if there's comradeship between George and Paul.
Yeah.
And it's like, you know, John's the guy who left the band and mm-hmm. we're still okay.
Right.
And so, again, it's mixed signals that we're getting.
It's very mixed signals. And that's the thing that I find very curious about the whole I want a divorce thing. Do I think he meant it at that moment? Yeah. Do I think he meant it generally? I'm not so sure.
Well, the fact, though, that he'd been mentioning it to Ray Connolly and Klein on the trip back means it was certainly not a spur of the moment thing.
No, I think he absolutely had been thinking about it, but I also think he wanted to sort of measure what the effect would be. Now, he had always framed that discussion in the context of, well, I brought in Cold Turkey to be the Beatles' next single.
Right.
Now, you know, not that I take anything he's ever said as gospel because we know better, but it was Jeff Emmerich, I believe, that said.
Here we go.
Now, listen, because you want to get the story right.
Yeah.
And, you know, and there's people in our social circle that would agree with me on this.
A few of them, yeah.
That John brought in Cold Turkey during the Abbey Road sessions, that it existed as of late August. Like, just as they were finishing up the album, notwithstanding the fact that he hadn't, in fact, quit heroin.
Yeah.
Maybe he quit it that week or something.
Right,
But he was back on it. Anyway, he brought that in, And the story as he spun it was, well, I brought that in to be the Beatles' next single.
Yeah.
And they rejected it. You know, his sort of framing that rejection was, well, they thought it was too personal or too strong or too raw or too edgy, whatever. Yeah. All right, that's what he said, and that was sort of what was informing his decision, why do I want to keep playing with these guys if they're not respecting, you know, where I'm at now, okay? The reality is, if you go back to the interviews at the time, what he was saying in 1969 was not that they didn't like the song or thought it was inappropriate for the Beatles, it was that it was too soon. Here they are.
Well, but that may be diplomacy because he doesn't want to say at the time that they don't like it, right? He's not. He's putting a positive spin on it.
Well, he's putting a positive spin on it in terms of, you know, it not tipping his hand that he has told them that he's quitting.
Mm-hmm.
You know, maybe he's still trying to keep that story tamped down, but, you know, he was still at that time not shy from, not as bad as he would get with Lennon Remembers, but,
right.
You know, if he had a criticism of his role in the band, you know, he was still saying things like, you know, I can't see working on an album for 6 months if I only get 3 tracks on it.
Right.
Yeah, what it cost him in terms of spending himself. But I get where the Beatles might not have wanted to take it up at that moment simply because they're about to drop Abbey Road. They've already designated something, this great, you know, in their eyes, George finally reaching our level as a songwriter, commercial standard single. They don't want to step on that.
They could have recorded it, though.
They could have recorded, but they weren't ready to. You know, maybe they were exhausted themselves.
I actually think it was a mistake. I would have loved to have heard the Beatles do Cold Turkey.
Absolutely.
And you know,
It's a very White Album-ish track.
Yeah, and who cares at this point about it being about heroin withdrawal? I mean, God, we've had John and Yoko naked on the cover of an album. You know, I mean, I don't think anyone's seeing them as the Mop Tops at this point.
No.
So
they've been drug arrested, as is George.
And it would have been another
time.
Groundbreaking Beatles single.
Yes. And they could have put Paul's junk on the back.
Right.
Thematic.
Yeah.
That's another issue.
Yeah.
But in any event, they didn't. And I have always wondered if they had. They said, sure, John. And, you know, he was in this mode at the time where he wanted everything instant.
Mm.
You know, going back to April when, right off his honeymoon, he writes Ballad of John and Yoko.
Yeah.
He wants to record and put out, notwithstanding they're about to drop their next single, Get Back.
Yes.
And you don't want to step on that. Plus, the Stones had Honky Tonk Women out at the same time.
Right.
You know, they were always very careful about commercially not dampening their sales by competing directly with somebody that would. So, but he's like blown past that mindset. It's like, well, no, I want it out now. This is news. This is in the moment. I have to have it out.
It's kind of interesting because the White Album sees John reporting on his life, okay?
Yes.
It's all over the White Album.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, you know, 68. And it's like by 69, he's decided that now, almost like a daily newspaper,
yes.
He wants to put out news about his life.
Right.
You know, as it happens.
Reporting, yes.
Yeah, let's not wait for the album.
Right.
Let's
we don't want
put
to be
it
stale
out
stale by the time it hits the
streets. Which, of course, is what eventually leads to sometime in New York City as you know, down the road, which I would agree with you, he takes it way too far. But, it, you know, in terms of everything about his life being of, you know, great importance to the whole world.
Yes.
But that is the path that we're embarked on.
Yes,
here.
That's the trajectory, which ended up, you know, he did take it too far.
Yeah.
And we'll get to it in this show where I think he absolutely nailed it with a fittingly titled Instant Karma.
Absolutely.
And then it just didn't work past a certain point.
Mm.
But anyway, that's where he is in the fall of 1969, late summer. He wants to record Cold Turkey with the Beatles. They don't take him up on it, but I always wondered, what if they had said yes, and they did do it, if they just recorded it, maybe put it out as a B-side of something?
Yeah, I know. I wonder what went behind that. You know, was it a purely musical choice or decision, I should say?
I think it was a business decision, a timing decision.
It may have been. It may also have been a personal thing. You know, it may have been that they were just pissed off with doing the John and Yoko dance.
Well,
you know?
Except to that point, they'd been so accommodating. You know, they worked so hard on his stuff, and they had been, you know, willing to indulge him. You know, I mean, look no further than the bed in the studio for the Abbey Road sessions.
Yeah.
You know, they'd seen it all.
Yeah, but remember, like, you know, with Two Virgins, where it's like, oh, come on, man. You know,
I mean,
that caused real panic in their ranks.
Sure, but the precedent, I mean, it took months for that to come out.
Right.
You know, they'd been done and ready.
But by the time of Cold Turkey, they must be thinking, you know what, we're not going to align ourselves with his heroin addiction.
No, but it's a positive spin, notwithstanding the reality they hadn't, in fact, quit heroin.
Oh,
it's like, here, I'm announcing to the world, you know, it was horrible. It's almost like it's an anti-drug commercial is what it is.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah, and it's very interesting that this is, you know, a solid year before Arthur Janov, and he's doing the Primal, you know, on the last quarter of that song.
Yes.
And he did get Ringo to play on it.
Absolutely.
So it wasn't like they were uniformly, no, we're not touching this garbage.
Right.
But still, he was incensed that they wouldn't, as they had, notwithstanding it's only two Beatles on Ballad of John and Yoko, and Paul did accommodate him and did put that out with him. This time it didn't happen twice, and he was like, well, I don't need this. So he announces that privately. But he doesn't say it publicly. And, yeah, they said, well, Klein is advising him, well, you're going to screw up the business. That never stopped him before.
Right.
You know, that comment about, you know, complaining to the press about, I'm not going to be jerked around, and I'm paraphrasing, by a bunch of businessmen in their suits in this city sitting around in their fat arses, you know, that cost them dearly because that was what precipitated Dick James deciding, well, you know, the whole house is imploding right now.
Yeah.
I'm going to sell this while I still can.
Yeah.
And that's exactly what happened.
Interestingly, George met with Dick James, didn't he? That's never widely publicized.
No, it is not. Yeah. And that's, again, despite all the dysfunction in the studio, it's so beautifully captured and Let It Be, and you know, things that have seeped out through the years, they closed ranks when it mattered.
Yes.
And here it is in the spring of 69 when both John and Paul are on their honeymoons. And they're, you know, Northern Songs is their baby. And while they're otherwise distracted, Dick James is he's pitching it around.
Yeah.
And George finds out and goes to see him. It's like, you know, you're going to, John and Paul are not going to like this. Why are you doing this?
Yeah.
And Dick James is like, well, it's business.
You know, interesting that George couldn't talk him out of it.
Right. No, I don't think he, you know, he didn't own George's song.
And interesting as well that post Get Back sessions, which had George leaving the band and getting progressively sick of the whole setup, it's just interesting that we have those little, you know, instances through 69 where George is actually behind the scenes trying to keep things together.
Absolutely. And it's very interesting because
it doesn't play in with the usual narrative that.
No, it doesn't. And there's a lot that doesn't play with the usual narrative that, you know, we can talk about in this show.
As with all things Beatle, there are always more layers to peel away at.
And there are so much in the way of myth, some of it self-generated, that gets, you know, hardened into fact through all these books.
Yeah.
You know, you really, really have to dig deeper and do not take at face value anything.
Absolutely.
Whether it's Jeff Emmerich's book or Lennon Remembers, you know, go to the source wherever you can.
Yes.
And that's why, you know, people, I'm sure they've said, asked the same of you, you know, did you talk to Paul? Did you talk to Ringo when you write your books?
Right.
I'm not interested in anything they have to say right now. You know, go back to then, and then you're going to get the real story.
Absolutely. But yeah, because things get revised, things get forgotten.
Oh, God, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So anyway, I'm Robert Rodriguez.
I'm Richard Buskin.
This is Something About the Beatles.
And this episode is about, really about early 1970, even though
where things come to a head publicly.
Right, exactly. Those first few months of 1970, which are kind of a make or break period.
Absolutely.
And we're also, as you can tell by now, discussing the events that led up to early 1970.
Yes. So where we had kind of looped back to was Paul's, or George's, or John, it's like talking to, you know, you have multiple kids and you always say the wrong kid's name. John's telling them that he wants a divorce.
Yeah.
And my questioning, did he really mean that? Maybe he meant that day, maybe he'd been thinking about it. But here's what his next actions are, okay? There is, he announces that he's going to put out, in fact, there was a studio session for the next Plastic Ono Band single. After he puts out Cold Turkey, uses part of his Toronto band and then Ringo, it doesn't do great commercially.
Right.
I mean, I think it made it as high as 15 in Britain.
Yes, yes.
But like only 30 in the U.S.
That's right.
He's not used to this.
Right.
Even Give Peace a Chance did better than that.
Yeah.
Okay?
It was, you know, foreshadowing what was to come. They'd have to all get used to this.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
And it is, you know, you look at it and listen to it, is that really a commercial hit single in the Beatles tradition?
Right.
Hell no.
Right.
I mean, rock had evolved to that point for sure. Yeah.
But, well, if Revolution wasn't going to be an A-side,
right.
You know, Cold Turkey.
And things were segueing away from the value of the hit single.
Mm.
You know, I mean, now it was album-length statements, and, you know, FM radio was starting up. You know, you get an FM track in rotation.
Right.
That's as good as a hit single.
But, I mean, again, it is a pity because 69, you know, the Beatles still lead the way with Abbey Road, but if you think of everything that was going on at that time in the rock world, on both sides of the Atlantic, how cool would it have been for the Beatles to do something as edgy as Cold Turkey?
Absolutely. Yeah. It would have really given them some street cred.
Oh, God, if they needed any, but it would have been more.
Well, right. I mean, at that point, you know, as the audience that had been with them since 63, 64 is aging out.
Yeah.
You know, and the younger kids, the younger siblings are like, well, you know, that's my older sibling's music.
Yeah.
Isn't it quaint?
Yeah.
You know, I'm into Led Zeppelin or
yeah.
Black Sabbath or whatever.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it would have been something that kind of recaptured that ground.
Also, you know, for me, the Beatles, the solo Beatles, post-1970, they stopped being innovators. You know, John is with Plastic Ono Band in terms of the approach.
Yes.
But post-1970, they're no longer leading the way.
No. You know? And one might make the case that post-67, they'd stopped, you know, what had been so important to them in early 66 when they went into the studio to make Revolver, throwing away the rule book and everything they know on how to make records. You know, they played that out by the end of 67.
Yeah.
Now it's back to their roots. It's a matter of the studio craft. You know, they know how to produce things. They know, you know, the sky's the limit in terms of what they need to bring to the table for any given composition.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they've done it all. And I think they'd gotten the accolades with Pepper and the validation that they didn't have to try so hard.
Well, anymore. That's right. To me, I've always felt that through Revolver and Pepper, they're still making it. They're still trying to prove themselves,
mm-hmm.
you know, and even like putting the lyrics on the back of the Pepper album, a total innovation at
right.
that time.
This is not going to be ignored.
That basically, look at what we're doing here.
Right.
Take these lyrics seriously. They knew people were taking the lyrics seriously. Some people were already
yeah.
with Revolver.
Poetry.
So, you know, at that point, you know, it's like they're trying to show the world. Post-Pepper,
mm-hmm.
it's like they don't need to.
Right.
That's the attitude to me, especially with Paul. That's why Paul starts sneaking in, you know, whether it's Your Mother Should Know or Oh Bloody, Oh Blood Out or Maxwell's Silver Hammer. At this point, he's just going to do what he wants to do.
Sure. You know, the detractors would perceive that as a type of arrogance,
mm-hmm.
but is that any more arrogant than bringing these deeply personal, non-commercial type songs that John was bringing in, or the Indian-esque things that George was bringing in?
Yeah, they're indulging themselves.
They're indulging themselves, absolutely. Yeah. And again, it's all in the wake of the death of Brian Epstein.
It just happens that John's indulging himself with better material.
And better drugs.
whatever works.
Yeah. No, actually, I mean, we've had this discussion before. It's when the drugs were taken away that the best material came out.
Right, yeah.
Yeah. So anyway, the fall of 69, Plastic Ono Band announces they're going to put out a single of Laughing, and they actually have a session for this. I think this might have been before Cold Turkey was released and stiffed on them,
mm-hmm.
because then John's next bright idea is to put out the song that they had in reserve, You Know My Name,
yes,
with What's the New Mary Jane,
absolutely.
As the flip,
yeah.
and put it out as a Plastic Ono Band record.
Right.
Here is him recognizing the value and potency of the Beatle brand, even if he's not calling it that, it's a Beatle performance, unmistakably. It's got Paul all over it.
Yeah.
So he wants to put
that
out.
It most certainly also plays into his self-admitted laziness as well.
There's that.
Yeah.
But he's not a commercial dummy.
No.
And he was as competitive as anybody.
Absolutely.
So, you know, that heroin song stiffs, okay. Laughing, well, that's probably not such a good idea right now. So then he aspires to put this out, and it gets announced. It gets a catalog number.
Yeah.
And the boom gets lowered on that.
Yes.
Nothing doing. You're not putting out Beatle material for your little side project.
Right.
Sorry.
Right.
So he gets the kibosh put on that.
We should also point out, by the way, that Cold Turkey breaks another, you know, trend, which is the Lennon-McCartney songwriting credit.
Right, and that was his
punitive
measure.
Give Peace a Chance was still Lennon-McCartney.
Yeah, and it's always been perceived as, you know, his thanks for Paul supporting him on Ballad of John and Yoko. I don't know if he actually said that or if that's just the way people have read it.
Yeah.
Now, keep in mind, Give Peace a Chance was recorded and released after the May 9th, 1969 meeting.
Oh, yeah.
Well, which we'll talk about in a minute.
Yeah.
But that was, you know, perceived as this real turning point.
Mm-hmm.
And supposedly, I don't know if it's Emmerich who says this, which therefore means, you know, maybe it happened, maybe it didn't.
It means
I'm never
right
with McCartney again.
Yeah.
Yeah. But anyway, put that aside. He's not allowed to put out Beatle recordings under his own brand. But what's the next thing issued as a Beatle product by the end of 1969? The Beatles' Christmas Message.
Oh, yeah.
Who dominates that utterly?
John and Yoko.
The guy who divorced himself from the Beatles, supposedly.
Yes.
There he's keeping that fantasy going.
Yeah, interesting that, isn't it?
That's why I see he was never shy about, if there was something he really felt the impulse to do, he did it.
Yeah.
You know, two virgins, returning his MBE, you know, whatever stunts he would pull, he knew the value of getting the media story, being, you know, out in front.
Mm.
But instead, he was kind of a reactive guy.
Mm.
And I think he was keeping his options open.
Yeah.
I don't think he was really, I think he wanted to see what was going to happen with the Beatles and if he needed them again, if his next outing on his own would stiff, it's like, well, maybe I better go back to the mothership. And
right. I don't think any of them, even when the split happened, even by April 70, were any of them, including George, thinking we will never work together again? They must have weren't even thinking about it.
I don't think those three were, but I think that once Paul heard those words out of John's mouth at Apple, I think for the first time that had been his tipping point. Mm-hmm. Because you look what happened to him. He disappears. He stops going to the office. He's broken. Mm. He falls into a depression, falls into this big drinking binge.
And as he would later say, he could identify with the miners in Britain being unemployed. Right. Oh, yes.
Well, yeah, Apple being the Welsh mining community that it was. It's a pretty apt metaphor.
What a load of tosh that was.
Right.
Anyway.
Well, but in his mind, you know, this was really his job and career and everything they built together. So I'm not going to diminish, I mean, because clearly it did have an impact.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, he bottomed out utterly.
Mm. Yeah.
And, you know, it's
he must have been an absolute joy to be around during those months.
Well, you know, Linda put up with an awful lot throughout their marriage, but at this point in particular.
Yeah.
Now, what is interesting is, you know, the fall of 69, you've got the whole Paul is dead thing starting in the month of October. And the Life magazine reporters who want to find out if there's a story here or not managed to track him down to his very remote, like off the map practically, Scottish farm.
In Campbelltown.
They're greeted with a bucket of water thrown at them by Paul. But then he recognizes, well, I should say something about this. So he lets them have their pictures, gives them their story, becomes a cover issue of November 69. But the little quote that's in that article, it was like ignored by the world because nothing came of it. It didn't become this big story where he literally says the words, the Beatles thing is over. He says that. So in his mind, notwithstanding what's going on with George, who's still kind of open-ended, working with John, you know, they do the Lyceum show.
Yeah.
He does the Delaney and Bonnie tour.
Yeah.
Ringo, who's working on Sentimental Journey now.
Yes.
With help from Paul.
Yeah.
And George Martin's orchestra, and John, who's obviously, you know, sort of keeping his options open. You know, he's doing all this peace stuff. He gets that Man of the Decade TV special done, and then he goes to Denmark.
Yep.
Where Tony Cox is with Kyoko. Well, ostensibly, they're going to visit Kyoko or Yoko's daughter.
Yes.
But as other people who saw them witness, it was like they were trying to detox.
Right.
They were coming off their drug thing, and they didn't leave till late January 1970 after the I Me Mind session, which, you know, he might have taken part in had he been around, mm-hmm. and maybe if they'd, you know, actually made a serious invitation to him, but he wasn't. And it was Alan Klein who pulled him out of there and said, no, get back to London now, mm-hmm. for whatever reasons. And no sooner does he return, but now we're talking January 26th, replaying in his head those conversations with Tony Cox and his wife, and it was his Tony Cox's wife Melinda who had come up with that instant karma phrase.
Yes.
And John takes it, turns it into a song, and wants to record it that very day. Boom. Acting on that total impulse to, you know, I have an idea, I have a song, I have a concept.
Yeah.
We got to get it out immediately.
Play loud.
Play loud. And who does he bring in? He brings in George.
Yes.
To support him on this.
Yeah.
Ringo was out of the country. He was in L.A. And Paul was holed up. Now we know he'd been working on his little Studer 4-track, recording some songs.
Yeah.
But he was out of reach as far as John was concerned. So, fine, I'm going to put this out. I'm going to record this with Phil Spector, who Klein had brought to London to possibly work on the Let It Be tapes.
Yeah.
Because, you know, that movie premiere date is looming. They need a soundtrack album.
Yeah.
So let's hear the raw performance, Vincent Karma, pre-Spector production. And this little band that John had put together before it got the full treatment that the world would hear.
Vincent Karma's gonna get you, gonna knock you right on the head. You better get yourself together, pretty soon you're gonna be dead. What in the world are you thinking of? Laughing in the face of love. Vincent Karma's gonna get you, gonna look you right in the face.
Better get yourself together, darling,
join the human race. How in the world are you gonna see, laughing at fools like me? Who on earth do you think you are? You are where we all shine.
karma's gonna get you. Gonna knock you off your feet.
Better recognize your brothers.
Everyone you meet. Why in the world are we here? Surely not to live in pain and fear. Why on earth are you there? When you're everywhere, come and get your share. Well, we all shine on like the moons and the stars and the sun. Yeah, we all shine on. Come on and on and on and on. Yeah, yeah. And the sun, where we all shine on, like the moons and the stars and the sun. Yeah, we all shine on, like the moon and the stars and the sun. Where we all shine on, like the moon and the stars and the sun.
Ooh, that's a tough one.
So George is very instrumental in the creation of this record in terms of it was he who had a hand in, I think, one of the, there was multiple keyboards going in it.
Uh-huh.
But in that this, you know, raw version of it, you hear a tiny little bit of his guitar.
Yeah, folks, play it back if you missed it. But at the very, very end, you'll hear just a little bit of fiddling around on guitar.
Yeah, and it's interesting that I'd read for years, oh, you know, George is credited with playing guitar. What guitar? There's no guitar in that track.
Right.
There's bass.
Yeah.
And until that isolation surface, like, I never believed it. I thought it was just a miscrediting.
I just love the way that John really belts on that vocal. You know, we're going back to Twist and Shout there, aren't we?
We're going back to the Cavern. And, I mean, just the opening, that some other guy opening those chords.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So it absolutely is him back in that primal rock and roll mode.
Yes.
You know, the anti-George Martin.
Right. Although we had heard him on Revolution also. Belt.
Yeah. But this is without even that kind of gloss. You know, this is as raw as it gets. And this is his most potent as a performer. The material suited it. Mm. And Spector completely intuited what the approach should be for this.
Yes. It works so perfectly, actually. The sort of chorus sound, you know.
Yeah. Bringing in the people from the club.
Yeah.
And Mayfair.
Yeah. It's fantastic.
Yeah. Billy Preston's involved.
Yes.
And Klaus, of course. And once again, Alan White on drums.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Which is, and that's like the lead instrument on that track.
Yeah.
It's unbelievable. And the sound they get, you listen to it raw like that, unprocessed.
Yeah.
Yeah. It sounds like somebody bashing away in a drum kit in a basement. But, you know, once Spector got his hands on it, it's like, it is otherworldly, practically.
And then you think about also those two wonderful appearances on BBC One's Top of the Pops TV show.
Yes.
And this is before the world knows about the Beatles.
Right. Right. Well, another thing that's interesting is it came out in England as Plastic Ono Band.
Yes.
It came out in America, where Klein had control, as John Ono Lennon.
As John Ono Lennon.
Yeah. Oh,
there's something I just love.
Like he's sort of setting the table for, John, you're going to have a solo career. I could see it coming, or at least separate from the Beatles.
Yes.
But now here's the thing. This is the first time outside the Beatles that John has done something that's really on the Beatles level musically. It's actually something that's going to compete in the charts, and it literally did, because now the Let It Be single is out, and while that was number one, Instant Karma was number three.
Yes.
So, if you're Paul McCartney, and you've been sort of, you know, sitting back and listening to, you know, John run his mouth and his little side projects that pose no threat whatsoever to the Beatles, now all of a sudden he's hit it out of the park.
Mm-hmm.
And he said that he wants a divorce, although he hasn't made that public.
Hmm.
You know, if you're Paul McCartney, you're thinking either John really, really means it and this Beatle thing is over. the next thought you're going to have is, I better step up my game.
Right.
So to this point, he's been recording, you know, the McCartney album secretly, mostly using his own home recording, you know, direct mic plug-in capabilities, although then he did some stuff at Morgan Studio. You know what he hasn't recorded to this point? The two most commercial, fully realized songs on that album.
Well, Maybe I'm Amazed.
Yes, and Every Night.
Right.
It was like he'd been keeping them in his pocket for what had, if John hadn't put out such a commercial and threatening release, instead done one of his other semi-experimental things, maybe Paul would have responded with his own semi-experimental
album. I mean, let's face it, Maybe I'm Amazed is Oh Darling Part 2.
Yeah. Oh Darling, you don't get the sense. You see him sort of channeling his 50s rock and roll.
Yeah.
Maybe I'm Amazed, you know that he means it. This is like, it's something that's very visceral to him.
Yeah.
It's its own sort of primer.
And if I say so myself, it's, you know, you don't get that too often with Paul.
You don't. You know, he doesn't, you know, tip his hand too often.
Yeah.
What I think is interesting, and maybe we're getting a little ahead of ourselves, but I will point out that, you know, the McCartney album comes out April 17th, and he does not pull a single from it. He just throws it out there as an album.
Which is also really strange. I mean, McCartney, of all people,
was Mr. Hit Single.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's just so strange that he puts out an album and doesn't pull a single.
But people were listening. None other than Rod Stewart, who he'd later work with when he wrote a song for him called Mind for Me in 74. Mm. He's with Faces, and he does a superb cover of Maybe I'm Amazed. Yep. Let's hear a little bit of that.
All right. This one you may well know. You may not know it. And if you don't know it, I really don't know where you've been, so you should know the tune. Here we go.
So, you know, I don't know off the top of my head how well the Faces version of Maybe I'm Amazed did, but they played it on stage for years to come.
Fantastic to hear Rod Stewart do it.
Oh, my God, yeah. And I know other people did too, but, you know, that was the hit that should have been and could have been, but wasn't.
Yes.
You know why that album was called McCartney, by the way?
Because his name wasn't Lennon?
No, because Unfinished Music Number 1 was already used for two versions.
Ah. Very good.
Yeah. No, my point being, it's very striking that he puts out this Declaration of Independence statement alongside the McCartney album. And if ever a case could be made sonically for the need for a strong collaborator, it's the McCartney album.
Absolutely.
You know, it's like all these musical doodlings alongside a couple, you know, handful of actual songs.
Yep.
Yeah. And we're not here to discuss the McCartney album per se, but just the context of it. You know, now, if you want to talk to the April 10th statement issued at Apple and all hell breaking loose when he announces to the world through this self-interview.
Which, by the way, I don't know if you know this. Mm. Everyone says a self-interview. Both Paul and Peter Brown in his book, The Love You Make, said that it was Peter Brown. McCartney didn't really want to do press for the album. He wasn't in that mindset, which that tells you how depressed he must have been.
Right.
And he said to Peter Brown, like, can you handle it? So Peter Brown actually came up with the questions.
That's Peter Emmerich's Peter Brown's story, isn't it?
That's Peter Brown's story, and McCartney has said so as well. Actually, he said it in about 1982 in an interview, I think, for a Canadian magazine.
Well, it's 12 years later.
Right, yeah.
What's he going to remember? But he read The Love You Make.
Yeah, well, whatever. Yeah. He certainly used it to his own ends. But
he did. And this is the striking thing, because you've seen that footage that news footage out in the street where somebody's holding up the newspaper, Paul quits the Beatles.
Yeah.
A Daily Mirror, whatever it was. He doesn't come flat out and say that. But let's look,
I've got it in front of me here.
Yeah.
The question, Peter Brown's question is, are you planning a new album or single with the Beatles? Paul says no. Next question, is this album a rest away from the Beatles or the start of a solo career? Paul, time will tell. Being a solo album means it's the start of a solo career, and not being done with the Beatles means it's just a rest, so it's both. Question, is your break with the Beatles temporary or permanent due to personal differences or musical ones? It's like, why ask that question, okay?
Yeah.
Paul, personal differences, business differences, musical differences, but most of all because I have a better time with my family. Ooh.
So he's laying out his musical
statement. One second. Temporary or permanent, I don't really know. And then the clincher for a lot of people was, do you foresee a time when Lennon-McCartney becomes an active songwriting partnership again? No.
Right.
Categoric. He's covered all bases there. He has a better time with his family.
Yes.
He's not going to be reviving the Lennon-McCartney songwriting partnership. I mean, he said everything but.
Everything but I quit the Beatles. And that's how it was reported.
Well, that's typical Paul.
Right. But he didn't. He also sidestepped some of these contrived questions. Are you planning? No.
Right.
But they didn't plan anything.
Right.
You know, that's the story with the Beatles, you know, post-Brian, is whatever happened, it wasn't like they laid out, you know, a year in advance what they were going to be doing. That wasn't how they operated.
But you got to see also from their perspective, though, the others. It's like a lot of these things, it's quite hilarious. It plays out like a comedy in a way, because if you bear in mind the pattern through the years of Paul always pushing himself forward, mm-hmm. Paul the scene stealer,
yeah.
You know, and Paul the guy who has to go public about taking acid, and here he's done it again.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the coup de grace, the ending of the Beatles, he jumps in again, and Lennon's absolutely furious.
He is furious because he was the one that got the headlines to sell a record.
Absolutely.
And he regretted sitting on his alleged resignation.
Yeah.
Which, like I said, I don't think was a serious thing, because he not even expressed any anger toward Paul or any real animosity up until that. That was what pushed Lennon over the edge.
Wouldn't it have been great to be a fly on the wall when John first read this?
He what?
Yeah, bastard.
Yeah, exactly. And that was when Connolly reports that when this happened, he talked to John. Mm. And John was like, why didn't you tell the world? Why didn't you report when I said I quit 6 months ago?
Yeah.
Well, you told me not to, John. You're the journalist. And he hung up the phone.
But also the childishness of this, you know.
Oh, my God.
Who's going to be the first one to say, well, I quit, you know.
Right.
It's the old, you know, you're fired. Well, I quit.
Exactly. Yeah. And that's what John literally said that. He goes, Paul didn't quit. I sacked him.
Yeah.
He had to have that distinction. It's so childish. But I really do think that Paul was possibly overreacting to the success of Instant Karma,
mm-hmm.
saying that, oh, wow, you know, John really is setting forward on a solo career outside the Beatles right now, competing literally alongside the Beatles. You know, I better get my act together.
Well, it's...
Because it's only then that he hadn't recorded the two best songs on the album until after Instant Karma, and
right.
That's when he booked time at the Abbey Road facility.
Yeah.
He hadn't done that.
Yeah.
He got his act together in the wake of Instant Karma.
Hey, come on, it's what was always missing afterwards, isn't it? It's the good old competition.
Yes.
And this is what we've lacked since 1980.
And I think that is the context for that statement being crafted.
Mm.
I mean, if Instant Karma or whatever record John put out that time had been a stiff or a non-commercial, Paul would have proceeded with his non-commercial, you know, semi-finished album.
Yeah.
And it would have been both of them getting solo stuff out of their systems. It without, you know, they still had the business divisions hanging over them.
Mm.
But I don't think Paul, until Instant Karma, saw John as abandoning and shedding his Beatle identity.
Well, let's face it. I mean, it was September of 69 when, you know, it's I Want a Divorce. The preceding month, August 69, post-final photo session at, you know...
Tittenhurst.
At Tittenhurst, we've got three of the Beatles and their partners going to the Isle of Wight concert.
Yeah, they're still socializing. And
yeah.
The only reason Paul wasn't there was because Linda was about to have Mary.
Right.
Or just had.
Right.
I forget which. But yeah, they were still very social, still, you know, despite all the business stuff. Now, to ratchet it back earlier that year, okay, the entire month of January is consumed by the Let It Be project.
Yeah.
Much acrimony, but it ends on the nice high note. They do the rooftop performance. The following day, they track Let It Be, Long and Winding Road, Two of Us.
Yes.
You know, nice performances for the cameras.
Yeah.
And then 3 weeks later, they start work on Abbey Road.
Absolutely.
Now, the conventional wisdom is, oh, they all walked away from Let It Be. They couldn't face it. It was such a terrible, you know, point in their career. They all went their separate ways. You know, John and Paul each got married, and George is producing the Krishna Temple, and you know, Jackie Lomax and this stuff. Ringo's making Magic Christian. It wasn't until Paul said, we can't leave that as our final musical statement. We've got to do something that shows the world what we can do. We'll get George Martin back to produce, and that, you know, in July, the summer of 69, they start working on Abbey Road.
Yeah, that's bullshit.
They've been working on it all year.
Absolutely.
They started 3 weeks after the Let It Be project, starting the track, I Want You, She's So Heavy.
Yep.
Now, if you've got anybody who has seen the pictures, this is actually documented in the Get Back book that came with the Let It Be package. Yep. There is that mystery session taken from behind Ringo where you see John and Yoko to the left and then George and then Paul all before Ringo. And you're looking over Ringo's shoulder.
Yes.
That's them working on I Want You.
Yes.
I think Apple Studios. I'm not 100%. It might have been, what's the other one they worked at? Not Olympic. Trident.
Trident.
Yeah. Yeah. So that started. They get married in March, then comes April, and they're laying down material that's actually going to be on the Abbey Road album.
Yeah, and Ballad of John and Yoko.
Well, they did the photo shoot April 9th.
Yeah.
That's the one where they're around the Rolls Royce and in the boat. And,
yeah,
so that's a big photo session. Get Back gets released on April 11th, like, you know, a year, just shy of a year before the announcement, as it were. They do that same day the Ballad of John and Yoko sleeve shoot at Paul's house with Yoko in the pictures, even though the song hasn't been recorded yet.
Yeah.
April 14th is when John and Paul record Ballad of John and Yoko.
Yes.
2 days later, they do Old Round Shoe.
Yeah.
As a group, as a foursome, they also start recording Something.
Yeah, you've even got John on a George track.
Yeah, right. And it would be very mixed low in the release, the piano.
Yeah.
But yeah, he's there.
Yeah.
And then they start recording days later, Oh Darling, in April. They record Octopus's Garden, April 26th.
They basically don't really stop for a break. They just kept going.
They
really kept
going.
Yeah.
May 4th, they have the Magic Christian Rap Party, John and Paul and Ringo partying together.
Yes.
So then comes that week. They record on May 6th, You Never Give Me Your Money, the backing track to that. It would be finished months later. May 8th, John and Yoko give an interview to David Wigg.
Yeah.
It comes out later as Beatles tapes. Then May 9th, the day that in Britain two Zappel albums come out. It's a Friday.
Yeah.
The four Beatles are at Olympic Studios. They're supposed to be supervising stereo mixes of the Get Back album as compiled by Glyn Johns.
Mm-hmm.
And a visitor shows up.
Yes.
Alan Klein.
Absolutely.
What ensues?
Yeah. Well, it's really what ensues is a dividing of lines. That's what ensues. You know, they're basically wanting Paul to put pen to paper.
Yes.
And I'm not sure how long this had been going on for. You know,
they had signed, the three of them had signed the day before. They needed Paul's signature.
Yeah, but how long had they been pushing Paul for this?
Well, okay, if you want to trace back Klein's involvement, he met with John and Yoko, I think, a day or two before the rooftop.
Right.
So back in January.
Late January.
Yeah. So you have these months between January and May where, you know, the Eastmans and Klein, you know, they're having meetings. And
and there's the meeting with Eastman, isn't there,
yes,
as well?
Well, he sent his son at first, which John saw as bad form and didn't like, you know, him coming off as this aspiring WASP Jew, as it was described later.
Yes.
Whereas Klein is their street fighting, you know, got this credibility of, you know, coming from, you know, the Hard Knocks school.
Whether this is true or not, as Paul would later tell David Wigg, that, you know, John's reasoning to him was, you know, when Paul pointed out his horrible record, you know, Klein, what a bruiser he was. And according to Paul, John said anyone with a reputation that bad can't be that bad.
Right. And then Paul asked Jagger, you know, he managed the Stones. And it's funny because Marianne Faithfull would later on in her book say, well, you know, some people say that Mick tried to warn them. Paul said that when he asked Mick, that all he had to say is, he's great if you like that sort of thing.
Yeah.
But Marianne Faithfull had to say that Mick secretly was trying to push Klein onto them, feeling that the Stones could then overtake them in rock supremacy when the Beatles got bogged down and ensnared in that quagmire.
This is like a history of Britain's royal family.
All Machiavellian.
Yeah.
All these moves being made.
We get to the May the 9th meeting.
Yes.
And they've been pushing Paul for some time. This has been bubbling under. And
It snaps.
And I can see both sides of this one. I mean, I can absolutely understand Paul saying, look, it's a Friday night.
Clients give them the song and dance about, oh, I have to go back to my board and meet with them tomorrow, so I need your signature. And Paul's like, your board's not meeting tomorrow. It's Saturday.
Right.
And besides, you're a power unto yourself.
Right. But the other side of that is, you know what, Paul? You've had months to think about this one. You know, this isn't a new subject.
We need this done now.
We're together now. Let's get this done.
Right.
And it's like, he's not going to.
No, he's not.
Yeah. And look, where would you point the finger? I'd point the finger certainly at John, who has been having Yoko as his mouthpiece at meetings already, you know, where he withdraws in his sort of heroin, you know, cloud and has her do the talking, which is beyond belief.
Right.
That is just beyond nervy.
And now he's bringing another toxic element into the world.
Yeah. And it's, you know, he and Yoko met with Klein. I mean, what's this about Yoko meeting with Klein, you know?
And how is that worse than, oh, if Eastman manages us, you know, you're going to get the better deal?
Right. I mean,
well, you're the one meeting in private with Klein.
Maybe a father was a banker, but I mean, so damn what? You know, this is ludicrous.
Yeah. Has history shown that he did Paul any bad service?
Right,
yeah,
right.
Quite the contrary.
On the other hand, did Paul have to just dig in and insist on his in-laws, you know, managing the Beatles? He didn't either. Why couldn't both John and Paul, this is where I point the finger at both of them, why couldn't the two of them have just, you know, acted like grown-ups and said, okay, I don't want your choice, you know,
We'll call it a draw.
Yeah.
Let's find a third party.
Exactly.
That's a uniter, not a divider.
And this isn't cutting George and Ringo out the picture, but I just get the impression that they would have gone along with whatever John and Paul suggested.
And honestly, with Lennon McCartney's catalog being the prize of this ensemble, you know, they had more at stake.
Right. So, absolutely.
And they'd already been screwed by Dick James.
Yeah.
As they saw it.
Well, as they saw it. Right. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, they earned it. But
They earned it. They did. So it's a real turning point there. And how awkward it must have been days later on May 13th when they go back to EMI to reshoot, you know, what's going to be the Get Back album cover.
Yep.
Yeah. And there they are, having had this really vicious fight.
Yes.
And put on the happy faces. Remember back in 63 when we were here?
Yeah.
Yeah. And so it's really bookending a career. Maybe that's what their thoughts were at that
moment.
Again,
just amazing that, you know, I mean, it's like, they've lived a lifetime since 63.
Yeah.
You know, so much has happened.
Absolutely.
And I'm sure they're still thinking, you know, they can pick this up. They'll get past this. They've had bumps in the road before, and they'll get through it. But that May the 9th meeting is, to me, the rupture. They could have absolutely come back from that. They could have patched things up.
They could have.
But that is where the battle lines are really drawn. Paul is pushed. He balks, and it's like, no way. And I'm not having three against one.
Right.
You know, in the past, it's always been, you know, unanimous decisions. Mm-hmm. Now we're going with the majority rule.
Right.
And I'm not doing it.
Right.
And as we know,
very different.
With Paul, it's no one's going to tell me what to do.
Right. Well, in this case, he was dead right. Yeah. And they should have recognized that and been grown-ups about it.
They should have been,
what
but
they
I
had
think his suggestion
risk.
Was also kind of ridiculous. You know, it was. It was ridiculous. He didn't have to go that route.
He didn't have to dig in. Didn't have to bring in somebody who, even if they hadn't listened to Mick Jagger, you know, George, who was a pretty savvy guy, he knew the lowdown on Yoko from his...
Well, I was going to say that. Yeah, he knew all about the bad vibes and what Dylan had been saying.
Which he was quite upfront about. But, you know, he would have been in a position to find out all there was to know about Klein. I mean, Klein already had been, you know, sued for various, you know, things that should have been enough warning. Don't touch this guy. He's toxic.
Yeah.
And they all kind of rolled over. And I do think, and I've said this before, that I think that George, despite the fact that John was not giving him any respect on his own material, not showing up for the sessions, I think George possibly saw an opening with this breach between John and Paul that maybe he could be the one to be John's collaborator stepping in. He'd gotten that taste of it with She Said, She Said.
A bit more treachery here.
Have we
ever had George talking about Klein?
Just after the fact, you know, like, I think,
Well,
Paul,
I know about,
Paul,
you
know,
might
about have
been
Bangladesh
right about concert and
all that
there's
stuff. That. Well, that's a ton.
Yeah.
And then he ends up buying... you know, my or He's So Fine and yeah. encountered, you know, suing George all over again. No love lost.
Yeah. None at all. But yeah, so that May the 9th meeting, as I said, to me is what turns out to be a fatal fracture.
In hindsight, yeah, because they did get the act together to go on and record Abbey Road and to collaborate on it. Mm. You know, if not actual songwriting, certainly, you know, major hands-on shaping the material, mm-hmm. like Come Together, mm-hmm. you know, which benefited mightily from Paul's involvement in it. You know, they do the side two suite. We, you know, John was of this mindset, well, I think we should put all my songs on one side and all your songs on the other side.
Right,
kind of childish position, which never in a million years have worked for the Beatles.
Yeah.
And or even flipping the sides, you know, get your crap out of the way first, and then we'll end with my song.
Oh yeah, and George will be on the EP. Yeah,
yeah, exactly. Yeah. So, you know, it just you look at it.
You know, that's the thing in anthology. You know, you have George sort of saying, you know, we were no longer willing to play the game after Abbey Road. You know, we're done with it. You know, but
again, that's a hindsight observation.
You get as far as September '69, mm-hmm. and they are really willing to play.
Yes,
the game.
They are. And in fact, you know, George is the one. George and Ringo happened to be at the Apple office on April 10th while hell was breaking loose, and George is upstairs being interviewed for this religious program. And Ringo, you see footage of him leaving the building.
Yeah.
And, you know, George was one that was interviewed not long after this broke. You know, somebody actually tracks down a Beatle to get his response.
Hmm.
And he says something to the effect of, I think the Beatles were very, very selfish to go their own ways when they have so much to give, so much energy as
Amazing.
A collective. Yeah.
Yeah.
And there was that statement we've talked about in the show before, you know, flower on its own is pretty, but a garden is beautiful.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah, of all people, you know, he's the one that is seeing the bigger picture.
Yeah.
And once they can get past this pettiness and this jealousy and insecurity, you know, let's take a step back, guys, and see what we've got here. But I think that breach where Paul stole a march on John by, you know, making this media event out of releasing his first album, I think that was what really snapped things, at least between John and Paul at that moment. It played out that way throughout the whole
rest of the year. Do we know when the press release, self-interview, whatever you want to call it, Peter Brown interview, when that was actually done, when he actually wrote those answers?
I believe the understanding is it was not long before it went public. Like, it would have been the week. But then you go back to March 30th.
Well, that's what I was going to get to.
Yeah.
Because we've got another complete rupture in the relationship on March 30th.
A real snapshot of how things were between
them. On
what
I might add, folks, was my 11th birthday. While I was celebrating my 11th birthday, Ringo was getting into it with Paul.
Yes, and here's the story. The story was that, okay, now the word is that Paul has put his first solo album up on the Apple roster schedule.
Mm.
Now you got Ringo's Sentimental Journey, which is now in its finishing stages in March of 1970. They're getting ready to release that right away.
Yeah.
They're thinking they want that out well in advance of the Let It Be soundtrack, which is scheduled for April, or late April, early May. And then, you know, Paul comes along, oh, I've got my album too. He wants it out immediately. He wants to do this John Lennon instant release. And they're like, no, why don't you put yours out in June? There's going to be a Capitol Records convention. You know, you can get a big splash, get all the media attention you want. And Paul's like, no, I'm not playing this.
But isn't this also amazing? You don't think about this, but, you know, often what happens with these bands when there is some sort of fracture or they just want to do their own thing, one or two of the members do their own solo albums.
Oh, yeah.
But here, you've got all of them having to do their own solo albums. Yeah, everyone's having to do their own project. Well, George isn't doing.
No, not that moment. I mean, he's certainly continuing to write material.
Yeah. But they're all busy doing solo stuff, you know, even Ringo. Is doing his own album. It's just kind of weird that they had to all do something.
Well, but it's interesting. I think they're taking note of the fact that they're not on the release schedule they once were on. You know, two albums a year and singles in between. You know, they can record now at their own pace.
Yeah.
They spent themselves utterly on 1968 doing this, you know, sprawling double album and a non-album single, A side and B side. You know, they then immediately go back, do the Let It Be project, which is still kind of hanging in the air in the spring of 1969. I mean, as late as the fall, it was being announced as coming out at Christmas time, and it never happened.
Yeah.
And then come early 1970, and they decide, well, it's going to be a theatrical release, you know, forget TV, and we'll put out a proper soundtrack album. So John and George craft a letter, and it's very sweet if you've read the actual letter. We thought a lot about yours and the Beatles LPs and decided it's stupid for Apple to put out two big albums within 7 days of each other. We're sorry it turned out like this. It's nothing personal. And they send Ringo, who, of course, of late had worked with Paul on the Sentimental Journey album.
Yeah.
You know, why don't you bring this over to him? You know, he'll be fine with you. You know, he has his moments with me, John, and, you know, certainly with George. But you can be the emissary.
Right.
And Paul flips out.
Yeah.
He reads it. And he's like, you know, get out. Get your coat on and get,
get
out.
Your coat on and get out. This
I'll
was
finish you.
Yeah, this is right. This was... Ringo reported this when in court depositions.
Yes,
you know, yeah, the following year,
and it was harrowing.
I love it. It was like, to my dismay, I think Ringo said, to my dismay, Tommy Tomorrow. I can't imagine Ringo saying, to my dismay.
Okay, his lawyer wrote it, and he signed it, or maybe George ghosted it for him.
But
nothing personal. Ringo rocks.
But I mean, what a scene that must have been.
Yes,
right? You know.
Yes. But that shows you the state they're in. So in that context where Paul is so full of rage at what he sees as the other two lining up with Klein to screw around with his solo career in the wake of Instant Karma.
I think in the Roy Carr, Tony Tyler book, it's reported as Paul threatened to finish off the nose.
Referring to Ringo as the nose. Right. So you have this very sad state of affairs now. Let It Be comes out. The world is taking this as the Beatles split.
Yeah.
You know, Ringo is
John who vaults over Paul's wall at Cavendish Avenue and like throws a brick or something at the window?
That one, if it happened at all, and there's conflicting reports whether people saw it happen or not, I've heard most reliably, because I think it actually got reported as hearsay, but it actually made the ink, in March of 1971, after the court ruled of the Beatles' money going to receivership. And so they'd lost that round in the Paul versus the other three. And that was when they did that.
I mean, can you imagine so going to Cav Ave to, you know, hopefully get a sighting of Paul, and you see Lennon sort of, you know, climbing up the wall?
Yeah. Where's that brick now?
Yeah, really.
So there's so much to talk about, but I think we've laid pretty much the groundwork for the April 1970 announcement and everything that kind of led up to it and the contextualizing of all that.
Yeah.
But it would be left to Ringo to sort of sum up his take on the Beatles' state of things between each other. The song titled Early 1970. Paul, he's wondering if he'll play with him. John, hoping he's going to play with them. They just did Plastic Ono Band together.
Yeah.
And George, I know he's going to play because we're always in town, you know, playing for you with me or wherever he says it. But a cute little song that George, you know, assisted him with the recording of.
Yes.
Came out as the flip side in April 1971 of It Don't Come Easy. Thanks for listening, folks. To be continued.
This has been
Something
About
the
Beatles. And just remember, every day is a Beatles Day.
Or next Beatles Day.
Lives on a farm, got plenty of charm, beep beep. He's got no cows, but he's got a whole lot of sheep. A brand new wife and a family. And when he comes to town, I wonder if he'll play with me. Laying in bed, watching TV, cooking. With his mama by his side, she's Japanese. They screamed and they cried, now they're free. And when he comes to town, I know he's gonna play with me. He's a long-haired, cross-legged guitar picker. Long-legged lady in the garden picking daisies for his soup. A 40-acre house he doesn't see, 'cause he's always in town playing for you with me. And when I go to town, I wanna see all three.
And when I go to town, I wanna see all three. And when I go to town, I wanna see all three.
Something About the Beatles, recorded at Strad Studios, produced by Thomas Rapetney. Executive producer, Rick Way.
The regular season is heating up, new stars are emerging, and that means more opportunities to win up to 25 times your cash on Prize Picks, the most exciting way to play daily fantasy sports. Just select two or more players, pick more or less on their projection on a wide variety of stats, and place your entry. It's that easy. Let it fly to turn $10 into $250 with just a few taps. Easy gameplay, quick withdrawals, and injury insurance on your picks are what make Prize Picks the number one daily fantasy sports app. Watch your favorite players and get paid doing it this basketball season. See your entries make progress during the game or make new entries for the second half and the fourth quarter. Three-pointers, assists, rebounds, and everything in between are yours for the taking. Join the Prize Picks community of more than 7 million players who have already signed up. Right now, Prize Picks will match your first deposit of up to $100. Just download the Prize Picks app and use code GET100. That's code GET100 on Prize Picks for a first deposit match of up to $100. Prize Picks. Pick more, pick less. It's that easy.